Mike Leonard, Leonard Trial Lawyers. How you doing, my friend?
John, great to see you. How are you?
Good. You wanted to rib me a little bit here at the start, as always. It's tradition.
I'm trying to test your credibility, John, because everywhere I go in Chicago this week, they don't want to ask about me. They don't want to ask about my bracket. They're like, how is John Hansen's bracket doing?
I didn't fill one out.
Oh, my God. You're not supposed to say that. That just ruins all your credibility.
I'm sorry. I know. I don't watch much college basketball. I don't feel like I know much about it, which doesn't preclude me because I usually still fill one out.
It does not. You should still do it even if you know nothing because you'll probably do better than me.
You know what messes me up is the Tuesday games. I know that they are not really part of the bracket per se.
Correct.
But it just throws off my whole week. Honestly, I was going to fill one out. But when I got to work and was working on Thursday, I realized the games had started, right? I'm just
excuses. No, actually, the great thing about the play-in games, what they do now is, so when you're filling out your bracket, you don't have to worry because you still pick that game, but you can pick blind. You can just say, okay, whoever wins that game is going to play this team next, right?
Yeah, okay.
And so you can just decide who's going to win, the team that's already in or that team from that portion of the bracket. So I think it makes it a lot easier for people. Because instead of having to get the brackets in Tuesday, you can get them in, you know, Thursday morning.
Well, I saw there were no perfect brackets left after the first round.
Oh, there never is, yeah.
Yeah. Who'd you pick to win?
So I'm in like four, unfortunately, fortunately. But I have Gonzaga and Xavier, and Xavier almost lost.
Oh,
I saw
that.
Was really, really stressed.
That's the other thing. I used to do like five or six, and I'm like, it's too hard to keep track. And then I'm rooting for different interests in different games. That's why I eventually just got down to one, and this year's
just zero. To give you a quick sense of the interest level in my house, my wife said to me the other day, Mike, not everybody thinks that NCAA the tournament is a holiday.
That's true.
Does that mean I'm spending too much time watching the games,
John? Yeah, you should be maybe helping out your clients a little bit there, Mike.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
Right.
Talking about ruining my credibility.
139 on WGN. Okay. I don't want to labor too long on this, but we have to talk about it, of course. It's a legal show. President Trump says he's going to be indicted on Tuesday for the federal case against him out of New York, right?
Well, actually, it's the state case out of New York. Yeah, so you have the Manhattan District Attorney has been investigating Trump for quite a while. Interestingly, and we'll talk about this in a minute, and I think this is a weak way to start, but it relates to the issue going back years ago with Stormy Daniels.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a relationship with her, apparently. And
he says he didn't.
He says he did. She says he did. Michael Cohen says she did. Whatever. But in any event, what happened was Michael Cohen.
His lawyer.
These facts, I think, are undisputed. Cohen was the lawyer for Trump at the time. He paid $130,000 payment to her attorney, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Trump reimbursed Cohen the $130,000, but they came up with like a fake retention agreement that made it look like the $130,000 that Cohen paid to Stormy Daniels to settle that claim was for legal services, not to pay her off.
Like they were like invoiced it, they spread it out over a couple months allegedly, and it just happened to magically be the exact same amount of money.
Correct. So it's the legal theory will be that in doing so, Trump either created false records or documents or created a false tax return because that wasn't a legal expense. That was an expense to pay somebody off. Or the best charge they're talking about, which would be a felony under New York law, would be that his actions in trying to pay off Daniels to have her not come forward was an attempt to influence the election, which I think is a tough one
to prove, very tough
to win. Because, look, in everyday life, and I've seen this before, people get claims made against them for things like sexual harassment, and they sometimes settle them, pay them money, have a settlement agreement. And it's done for no other purpose than to avoid embarrassment, avoid litigation, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's a very tough way to start. If you're going to prosecute Trump for anything, I would say if you're a prosecutor, take your strongest hand, bring your strongest case first. This, to me, does not seem like the way to go.
Can you argue if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck? Is that a legal argument to make? Saying that President Trump was running for office at this time. Sex scandals historically have had a negative effect on candidates. Put one and two together, people. Or can you not do that?
Well, look, of course you can try to make the argument. Whenever I say walks like a duck, talks like a duck, Your Honor, I usually don't win. But just so you know, John, in a courtroom, it doesn't seem to be a successful argument. But yeah, that's what they would argue. But of course, the defense would argue, look, there's many purposes to settlement agreements. They're not simply because he wanted to influence election, and I doubt it would have had any influence. I'm not a big pro-Trumper, as you know, but there's lots of other explanations that people understand why people enter into settlement agreements, right? to avoid embarrassment, to avoid litigation.
That are all legal.
Yeah, of course.
But the payment system may have been the one that was a little quirky, but then again, would that be a misdemeanor if it's just the payment?
Yes, some of the charges they're talking about would be misdemeanor level. I think that the strongest charge they've talked about, which would be violation of a New York state law to influence election, that would be a felony, apparently.
Okay. He obviously is potentially facing an indictment out of Atlanta. We're all waiting to see what will happen there because the grand jury is wrapped up, and we talked about that a couple weeks ago. You noted something interesting in the third case that a lot of people have their eyes on after the Mar-a-Lago raid. That one. What happened this week in that?
Yeah, so a weird kind of technical legal thing is going on down there. There's a grand jury investigation into the handling of the Mar-a-Lago documents. We all know that. And so they called as a witness before the grand jury one of his attorneys, one of Trump's attorneys, who apparently either refused to answer questions entirely or refused to answer certain questions, mm-hmm. right?
Is that usual how that happens?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, no attorney would go in there and willingly say, yeah, let me tell you about my client.
Sure.
That would absolutely never happen.
Okay.
And so, but what the government did in that case, and apparently we're saying this because this has been reported, but the order from the court is under seal. So we know what's been reported about the order under seal, but we can't see it. But apparently a judge has issued a ruling saying that what's called the crime fraud exception applies, meaning if you're utilizing the services of attorney to advance a crime, your communications are not shielded by the attorney-client privilege.
So normally if I went and talked to you and I told you I committed a crime, I needed some help, that's all protected.
Correct. You could tell me that. You can't get my advice on what steps to take to commit a crime, what steps to take to cover it up, et cetera. Those would be non-protected communications pursuant to this crime fraud exception doctrine.
Does that bother you, that doctrine?
It does. You know, we talked about
this. You're a defensive attorney, right?
Yeah, it does bother me. I mean, the idea is you shouldn't, I understand on the one end, you shouldn't be able to go to an attorney and say, hey, here's what I want to do, right?
Right.
Here's how I want to commit this crime. How can I do it? It makes sense practically. Here's the difficulty in real life. And I had this come up in a federal case down in St. Louis, is that the government often gets production of documents, has a group of people who aren't part of the prosecutorial team, but they're members of their office. They look at the documents and they say they're supposed to normally not look at the attorney-client protected ones. And they say, gee, we see these documents that don't appear to be protected by the attorney-client privilege. Let's go to a court and get an order and say this crime fraud exception applies. We get to see all these communications. So a lot of stuff happens where eyes are on documents, in my view, that shouldn't be there. And therefore, it leads to decisions by judges that certain documents aren't covered by the usually protected attorney-client privilege.
So to be fair to say, you don't like the process in which someone would be able to argue that it was outside the realms of attorney-client privilege because the process in which they saw that violated what you think would be attorney-client privilege.
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
And it's difficult, though. So the question would be, well, heck, how do we ever know
That's true.
If the communications are an attempt by a client to further a crime or cover up a crime if a judge can't see them in the first instance? I get it.
Okay. Let's take a break here. I want to talk about Madigan. We got a couple questions on the text line and the phone line. You ready to do those?
Let's do it, John.
We'll do some rapid fire with Michael Leonard after this. Mike Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers. And Mike, what number do you want people to call, by the way?
312-380-6559, John.
Okay. After this on WGN. 720 WGN. A few more minutes here with Mike Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers. You ready to take some calls, Mike?
We're good to go, John. We're done. We're done criticizing you for your lack of a bracket and your engagement in normal everyday affairs. But let's go.
All right, I appreciate that. Let's go to line two, John. John, what's your question for Mike?
Well, I've been following the Madigan trial, and you know, in the paper they put the testimony that Lang gave, and it seems really weak. So, like, what's the prosecution trying to get with that testimony?
What's the prosecution trying to get from the Lang testimony, Mike?
Yeah, so just so the viewers understand, the ComEd 4 trial, which is getting a lot of publicity, in essence alleges that four individuals conspired to attempt to influence Speaker Madigan by currying favor with him by way of most directly ComEd giving jobs, contracts, subcontracts, consulting, lobbyist work to individuals who Madigan favored and who wanted to be paid. Not that Madigan was being paid, but these other people affiliated with him were getting contracts and benefits from ComEd. So the government's case, in my view, which the trial started this past week, I think started off weakly. They're trying to lay a foundation that, gee, Madigan was all-powerful. He could do whatever he wants. So one of the key early witnesses they called was this guy, Lou Lang, a former state representative, member of the Illinois legislature, formerly. And what they had him testify to is, gee, you had a situation where someone made allegations against you, part of the Me Too movement. He denied that there were sexual harassment allegations. They were widely reported that they were, be that may as it may. With the testimony from Lang was that he gets a call from the defendant, from a defendant in this case, Mr. McClain, who was the kind of the right-hand man to Mike Madigan.
Okay.
And McClain says to him essentially, hey, in coded language, hey, the speaker wants you to resign. He doesn't say it that way, but that's basically what he's telling him.
Right.
And that's supposed to show how much power and influence Mike Madigan has. And, you know, to lay this groundwork that Mike Madigan is so powerful. But to me, it's really weak evidence, because in any state house in the country, if a guy is going to embarrass the party or is in hot water and the leader says to him, hey, look, you should probably call it quits, that's going to happen anywhere. You know, so
right.
To
they're
me,
not alleging that that's illegal. They're just trying to show power as
correct.
A, like lay
yeah.
a foundation.
Correct.
Here.
They're not saying that act is illegal, but they're basically saying this shows how much power he has. To me, it was a weak start, because any legislative leader anywhere in any body is going to tell somebody, hey, look, it's time to hang it up. Because you're embarrassing us, you're putting us in a bad light. So to me, I don't think that was a good start for the government.
Okay, sounds good. We got another caller. You got those headphones working
sure.
yet, Mike?
There
yeah. we go. All right, let's go to line one. And Jim. Hey, Jim, you're on WGN.
Hey, John. Hey, Mike. I really love the show. You guys do a little bit of weather and a local interest story, and you got the whole you know, shebang. You
right. Jim, we're trying to cover it all here.
Yeah, right?
We got sports. We got politics. It's awesome.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, continuing on both the Trump and the ComEd 4, like jury selection for trials like that, I mean, they've got to be hugely like politically tinged and also very complex to understand, like, you know, peddling influence and ward, you know, assignments, et cetera. Like, how do you select a jury that's adequately intelligent, that can understand what, you know, let's say a prosecutor is actually implying?
Without being too biased, right? Exactly.
Exactly.
All right, Mike,
exactly.
What do you think?
Jim, that's a great question. I mean, this comes up in a lesser degree in a lot of federal trials, but something like this, which is getting so much publicity and notoriety, and also, in my view, needs a level of sophistication. So one of the things that they typically do pretrial-wise is to give a very detailed, lengthy, long juror questionnaire with input from the attorneys about, you know, trying to ferret out biases, you know, political biases, political exposure, you know, interest or ties to Madigan, views about ComEd, you know, views about law enforcement. So you try to do that. But then the problem is in most federal courts, including this one in Chicago, is you don't really get a long amount of time to sort of voir dire, it's called, but to question the jurors before the trial starts. So it's very difficult, Jim, to get a real good sense of who everybody is and what their biases are. A lot of times you're going from your gut and you're going from your experience. And then a bigger problem, I think, you know, twofold, is this case is getting a lot of publicity. So, you know, I don't believe for a second that jurors don't read, don't hear things on the news about the case. They're told every single day, don't read anything about it. Don't talk about it. Don't listen to anything about it.
How
do I
not?
Believe that that happens? No, I don't, quite frankly. So that's difficult. So then you're getting the news slant influence on the story and the witness testimony.
Yeah.
And then I think Jim raised a great last point, which is, you know, how do you get jurors that really can grasp the concepts here and who can apply the law?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's
so
hard.
You know, but this one's interesting because, you know, it's basically a conspiracy to influence someone else. The government doesn't even have to prove that Madigan and the House passed a specific piece of legislation on behalf of ComEd. It's just the fact that these people made these overt acts, these attempts to influence him, right?
Yeah, that's enough.
Yeah. And so I would be troubled, but I mean, you might get jurors who don't have a lot of exposure to the political system, and that would worry me. Because
as a prosecutor, as a defense?
As a defense lawyer, you know, so if you get people who are pretty uninterested or unsophisticated in the ways of politics and the political process, they may think that a lot of this evidence, in my view, so-called evidence presented by the government is strong. And to me, a lot of it is just normal negotiating.
Political stuff.
Political
this
stuff.
Happened with the Blagojevich trial.
Correct.
Too,
where stuff, you know, people debate over things. Everybody, of course, from different companies,
right.
different interest groups is trying to influence the members by contributions and other things. And the idea is that they all hopefully would cancel each other out. So I think someone who's doesn't know a lot about the system, that might be troublesome for a defense lawyer because I think the jurors might overrate some of this evidence.
Right. Okay. Good question, Jim. Got 30 seconds to answer this one, Mike. I want to know, this is from the texter, if I have a right to request the people who deliver things from Amazon or anyone else not to take a picture of my home. I request it. They ignore it. And I wonder if it's because I don't have a right to ask that. Mike, 20 seconds.
Well, certainly, John, you can always ask that. I don't think there's any law that would apply, any right to privacy law that would say you can't do that. You know, absent some statute at the local level, state level, or federal level that gave you sort of a right of privacy, you would have really no legal grounds to stand on, but you can always make the request. But it's a public domain, so if you're just taking a picture outside of a public building, in my view, no different than taking a picture of a restaurant or bar, where I know you go a lot, John,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. LeonardTrialLawyers.com. It was rapid fire, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John. Appreciate
it. The phone number one more time.
312-380-6559.